Because the U.S. Surgeon General says it's bad for you, and the Washington Attorney General says it's worse for kids than voting. More in a moment. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to make you smart about the important stuff that happened this week. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. We begin today on a serious note. This week, we said a final goodbye to a beloved Northwest icon, the Save the Kalakala story. The Save the Kalakala story was manufactured more than 20 years ago, a beautiful example of the Northwest style of journalism. This week, the Save the Kalakala story was finally laid to rest. It is survived by the Save the P.I. Globe story and the Bring Back the Sonic story. Knut Berger has asked for the media to respect his privacy at this difficult time. Knut, our thoughts and prayers are with you. Knut is the Moss back at crosscut.com. Welcome back. Good to see you, brother.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Seattle Times opinion writer Jonathan Martin. Jonathan, I noticed the Times flag is at half staff because of the demise of the Save the Kalakala story.
Let's all just take a moment.
It will be missed. Deborah Wong is a reporter at KUOW and host of In Close on KCTS Public Television. How's Felix Bunnell doing today? How's he holding up?
I think he's probably pretty sad like the rest of us.
Felix is a local historian. I think today we can say we are all local historians. Thank you for turning into the Week in Review, and let's get at it. Now, if our legal smoking age were 21 in Washington State instead of 18, how would that have changed your life? I ask because our state is thinking about giving Washington the highest state smoking age in America. There's a bill in Olympia to do that. The state attorney general is lobbying for that. We asked you on Facebook. You know, we're at KUOW Public Radio on Facebook. We asked you on Facebook how you feel about the change, and Yvonne said, I wish something had made me think twice. And that's the idea, right, Deborah? Yes, we're being a nanny state, but even teenagers need nannies.
We're being a nanny state, and, you know, it would set us really very far apart in the United States because most states have 18 as the legal age that you can smoke. A couple states have 19, but nobody has 21. But this is a movement that started in cities. Apparently, there is a movement. I didn't realize there's a movement, but several years back in the town of Needham, Massachusetts, which is near Boston, the Needham Town Council decided to raise their smoking age to 21. There was very little fanfare, but by word of mouth, apparently, other towns around, you know, the western suburbs of Boston all started doing this, and they were going doing this because there was a Harvard researcher who found that after Needham raised its smoking age to 21, the number of teenagers who were smoking declined precipitously, like 50%. And researchers are now finding that, for the most part, when people become smokers, they start when they're teenagers. So it's really a critical time. And brain researchers are also finding that for a lot of addictions, not just smoking, but for alcohol and drug addictions, teenagers are much more susceptible to drugs, to alcohol, to smoking than adults, because your brain is still developing. So it kind of makes sense, although it really would put us, you know, kind of in the vanguard once again.
You know, this idea that they raised the age in Needham, Massachusetts, and the early smoking rates dropped off goes against what one of our listeners said on Facebook, because we asked whether a higher smoking age would have changed your life. And Jonathan said, yeah, definitely. Like every teenager I knew back then, the first question I asked before I started smoking anything was, wait, is this legal? But I'm one of those more rule following, you know, as a kid, I think it would have really deterred me.
It's a difficult idea to argue against, because you end up sounding like a shill for, you know, R.J. Reynolds if you say no. There is an argument, the nanny state question. You know, we have disallowed smoking in bars. Great. So you don't come out of a restaurant smelling like an ashtray. But on the other hand, if you're 18, you can go fight and die for your country. You know, we let you behind the wheel of a, you know, 2,500-pound vehicle. So I understand the I understand the public health arguments for it, and certainly the state has an interest because the state ends up paying a chunk of change for most health care.
More than the state would lose by losing some cigarette tax paying buyers?
That's actually one of the – right now, e-cigs are not taxed. And I find it's an interesting – you know, if we're talking about like regulating the heck out of a cigarette when we already do and tax it. And right now, the loophole for it – the loophole on – this vice is on e-cigs. You know, my my son came home from middle school last year and was talking about kids vaping on the basketball court, and like, you know, my eyebrow shot up and like, whoa, hold on a second. Okay, I understand the arguments, but if we're going to go down this road, let's kind of start with the e-cig kind of thing, the vaping kind of thing, which is kind of the cool new thing.
Well, under this proposal, my understanding is that we're talking about cigarettes, chewing tobacco, e-cigarettes, all of that would be 21 or over. I don't know about the taxing mechanism for e-cigarettes.
So the Senate bill says any cigar, cigarette, cigarette paper or wrapper, tobacco in any form or vapor product. If you sell to someone under 21, you're guilty of a gross misdemeanor. And interestingly, the FDA is apparently looking at this as well. I didn't realize this, but Congress ordered the FDA, I guess last year or the year before, to look into raising the smoking age. So this is something that might happen on the federal level.
How many times have we said that lately? Washington State, and it might happen on the federal level. Anything to add, Knut?
Well, I was just – I mean – go back to my own experience. I agree with the Facebook. I started smoking, I guess, at 15, yep. And I certainly wouldn't recommend that. But I also grew up in a different era when virtually everybody smoked. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of your sign of reaching adulthood. You know, was that? I do think it's
your
weird.
First bad decision. You're finally grown up.
Yeah, I finally grown up to me. Yeah, no, I'll never forget. You know, when I was probably 16 or so, sitting in the living room with my father. I'd been smoking on the sly for, you know, a year or two. And then I remember the day when my father reached over and offered me a cigarette, you know.
Mm.
And it was sort of like unspoken. It was like, you know, you're finally a man, you know, type of deal.
Wow.
But this idea of when adulthood begins and when you can make adult decisions, I think, is really interesting. And I understand the public health element there, but I think there ought to be one standard for when you're considered an adult legally, and it's 18 as far as criminal activity is concerned, as far as the military is concerned, as far as most decision-making, being a dependent and all that. I think it ought to be consistent. I think adults ought to be able to make decisions as to what they decide to put in their body, whether it's good or not. I think the thing they're trying to interrupt here is that 18-year-old with a legal cigarette is more likely to buy an illegal cigarette for a 16-year-old than a 21-year-old. In other words, just because of the high school milieu, you know, you're
okay.
So I think it's disruptive.
So you raise the age to 21 so that the 19-year-olds can't get it to buy it for the 15-year-olds. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
well, why don't we just raise the age to 25 to keep the cigarettes out of the hands of the 21-year-olds who might buy it for the 15-year-olds?
Yeah, exactly. I just think. I think we ought to have one standard for when people reach adulthood. If it's 18, it's 18. If it's 21, it's 21, and not have the variance. So.
Well, Knut, the country went through this when we raised the drinking age to 21. And the reason we raised the drinking age was because we were worried about highway fatalities, right? And when they did raise the drinking age to 21, highway fatalities went down dramatically. So isn't there a kind of a parallel argument here? It's a question of, you know, potentially saving lives.
Yeah, there is, and I understand that. And it sounds like the evidence for this working is not on the scale of what you're discussing. So, you know, maybe it's worth further study. But generally, I think there ought to just be one adulthood standard.
Well, are we going to differentiate between the intoxicants and the non-intoxicants? I mean, we do that with marijuana right now, and the marijuana stores require 21. Alcohol requires mm-hmm. 21 because these are mind altering, and you get behind the wheel, and you know there's bad things that can happen. I mean, I don't know. I guess there's some psychoactive properties of a cigarette, but it's not quite the same thing.
Right. I think it's just the long term addiction issues that they're worried about, and what we know about the brain, which is that the brain becomes more easily addicted when you're a teenager.
I feel like we've learned in general that the brain keeps developing longer than we used to think, that right. teenagers are kind of kids.
Right. And that is actually an argument for raising adulthood, the standard to be
right. 21. Just make it mm-hmm. consistent.
Just make it consistent and make it older than we thought. And that would change a lot of things. But you can argue that we're now learning that people's brains are still developing well into their into their 20s.
But policy isn't consistent there. We charge 13-year-olds with first-degree murder and let them sit in prison for the rest of their life.
Right.
So we got a long ways to go to be consistent with public policy about the age of knowledge and the age of consent.
We talked to some young smokers in Olympia. 19-year-old Kiki Carter says 21 years old to smoke, that's the dumbest thing she's ever heard.
If we're considered adults at 18, we should be able to smoke. I mean, we can go fight for our country and die. Why can't we die another way?
Yeah, why don't you want us to die? So we'll see. Does that, just real quick, odds of this going anywhere in the legislature? Do we feel like we're gonna go to 21?
I have no idea.
Jonathan shaking head.
Not even close,
no.
I think.
No.
Yeah.
No. Have bigger problems?
Yes.
KUOW's Week in Review. We're on Twitter, as always, live tweeting at KUOW. I'm with Deborah Wong and Jonathan Martin and Knute Berger. And very briefly, before we take a break, you know how you convince yourself that your home team is the good guys, even though it's not really true? Now it is true! This week, the Seahawks' Super Bowl opponents, the New England Patriots, got caught letting the air out of footballs in their last game, so you were going to root for the Seahawks anyway. Now you can feel superior about it. Good, right?
Well, we don't know that they let the air out of footballs. We're still awaiting the NFL investigation on that.
If the Patriots didn't let the air out of the footballs, who let the air out?
Somebody did.
Some prankster?
Some, who knows?
Come on.
No. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty funny. I mean, Tom Brady got up and spoke at a press conference. He's the quarterback for the New England Patriots. And no ex-NFL player believed him.
No, right.
You know, yeah. I mean, it was just roundly mocked by every other quarterback that nothing he said passed the smell test. Seattleites, we always love feeling morally superior
yes.
to everybody. I certainly am swelling with more, you know, local pride for the Seahawks, who can do no wrong, whether they're crotch grabbing or smack talking.
There is certainly a parallel here that the Seahawks got $30,000 in fines for grabbing their crotches yes. in the game. Yes. So I'd like to see what the deflation of the balls fine is going to be.
Well, we know they're going to be checking the balls very carefully at the Super Bowl.
Well,
it's going to take hours longer because they're going to be checking all the time.
Don't check those all the time, people, okay? By the way, Tom Brady said it wasn't him, but he did admit that quarterbacks all play with balls in their own way.
You know, everybody has a preference. Some guys like them round, and some guys like them thin. Some guys like them tacky. Some guys like them brand new. Some guys like old balls. I mean, they're all different.
They're all different. Now, with this scandal, doesn't this mean that the Super Bowl footballs are definitely going to be fully inflated, so the Patriots are not going to know what to do with these regulation football? It'll feel like throwing the PI globe around to them. Advantage Seahawks, right?
But you know what, Bill? Even they apparently switched out the deflated footballs at halftime, right? Yeah. And then the Patriots went on to crush the Colts. Oh. It didn't matter what was in those footballs. Right. They would have won.
I got to say, it's a fun opponent to hate.
Yes.
Bill Belichick has all the charm of like a long haul truck driver.
Yes.
Next to Pete Carroll, who's like a camp counselor.
Yes. You know. I wouldn't touch him with a 31.5-foot pole. Okay, we're back at Week in Review. I couldn't think of any other Grinch references. There's three words that best describe Bill Belichick, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk. Back with a Week in Review in a moment. Stay tuned. In Review here on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. We just heard the breaking news that Bernard Ouellette passed on to you, that we knew that the city council, Seattle City Council's longest serving member, Nick Licata, just said this week he's leaving. And now we just found out a few seconds ago that Tom Rasmussen is leaving. Any reaction? Is this gonna change things in Seattle?
Well, yes. In fact, I think it's really interesting that you have two city council incumbents, both of whom I think were fairly, you know, expected to probably have pretty good reelection chances in their districts, announced. So the new district system was in part designed to shake things up, and it has. Even before the votes have been taken, it already has.
This is the fact that instead of being elected citywide, you have some of these seats will be district by district.
That's right. 7 of the 9 seats are by district. Tom Rasmussen would be in the district that represents West Seattle. Nick Licata is in a North End district, Northwest Seattle. And so it's changing the political calculation about where your base is, who you can appeal to, whether you're running against colleagues or not. I know that was at least a partial factor in Nick Licata not wanting necessarily to run against Mike O'Brien, who lives in the same district. So it just shows that the district, the implementation of the new district system is already having an effect. We're seeing a lot of council candidates come forward in some of these districts, and now we're seeing incumbents deciding to take a pass.
You know, Newt's right about this doing what it was intended to do. This was supposed to be a rug shake. The city council had been pretty stable and constant for years. I mean, Licata had been on for, I think, 16 years. And Rasmussen, I believe, has won at least 2 re-elections. So you have a council that has really not turned over much, even as the city itself is turning over rapidly. And you also have the oldest council. I mean, I think Sawant, I believe, is the youngest city council member in her mid-40s. And it's really striking in a city that's getting increasingly younger, tech-savvy, and it's growing rapidly that you don't have a city council that looks like the city.
Okay. So, again, a couple of city council members bite the dust as they move on. More to come on that. This is the Week in Review, and this week, hundreds of people, including Governor Inslee, came out to protest possible big cuts to Joint Base Lewis-McChord. KOW reporter Patricia Murphy was there, and now she's here. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Bill.
Why would JBLM cut up to 11,000 jobs?
Well, a small part of that answer is the drawdown. We're no longer in Iraq and Afghanistan the way we were a few years ago. That's a small piece. But the biggest piece is actually the forced budget cuts known as sequestration, which Congress has not repealed yet. And that would force the Pentagon to cut $500 billion from its budget over the next 10 years. So that's 90,000 cuts force-wide they're talking about. And again, huge cuts down at JBLM, 11,000 potentially.
So how do JBLM's neighbors argue against those reasons?
Oh, it was crazy town. I mean, they put out the word that this was your opportunity to tell the big army what this meant to you. And everybody turned out, every city council member, every government agency that has anything to do with veterans or military was there. It was huge. Small business owners, Tacoma Power and Light. Who knew, right? Biggest customer, JBLM. Very important. And this was their opportunity to tell them this, and they did make their cases.
What was their case?
Well, you know, I mean, and this is funny because I sat there and I thought, who else isn't making the same case? We love our military. We've invested in our military, you know.
But at every base in the country.
Yes, because it would be silly not to invest in the military. It's a huge economic driver in your community. But, you know, they were hoping that the people who were on the G team who are listening to this to bring this information back to the Pentagon hears the sincerity in our voice that we are truly invested in our military and in turn, the military has invested in this area. Millions and millions and millions over the courses of the war have been invested in JBLM to grow that base.
So what makes these people think that the Pentagon isn't smart enough to figure out where it needs big military bases?
Well, I don't think they see it that way. And the reason is because this, again, was their opportunity to make the special case for the Pacific Northwest. And sequestration, which is what is hugely at play here, is a blunt tool, right? This was supposed to never come into play. Mm-hmm. This was the, we're going to do this unless you fix your budgets. This was the worst case scenario. And so it doesn't, sequestration is not a surgical instrument that we can use. And if we could make our case appropriately, perhaps sequestration is the blunt tool that doesn't encourage the surgical cuts. And if things were different, like the Stryker Brigade, we could lose the Stryker Brigade, which we did because we no longer needed them.
Mm-hmm.
5,000 troops were gone there. We want the military to understand that this is the place to be. And I think that we have a special case. But
What's so special about JBLM, according to the people who want it bulked
Well,
up?
We love them, but I think we have an even more special case, which is the Pacific Shift. We have made it clear, and we now call it the rebalance, it's no longer the Pacific Shift, that China is where we're setting our sights. Mm-hmm. And we are strategically placed here in the Pacific Northwest for that. And the other one, which I don't think anybody's really talked about, and this is just my personal opinion, is that the Navy is making a pitch for an electronic warfare range here on the Olympic Peninsula and the Okanagan National Forest. Mm. If that is permitted, that would allow this part of the country to incorporate ground troops into the Navy training on the peninsula, again, facing the Pacific. We are strategically located here to fulfill that mission. So I think all of those things at the Pentagon level make some sense, right, that we do have a special case here in the Pacific Northwest strategically to keep our troops at a higher level in this area.
Always interesting to see even probably conservative military culture types making the case that we need more government money around here in this case. I mean, the Pentagon has constituencies every place in the United States. It's one of the things that makes it very hard. They have a lot of backyards to have things not happen in. Any other thoughts before we move on?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, The military and the defense industry, I think, rank either number two or three in central Puget Sound mm-hmm. as economic drivers. And when you think about it, Thurston County, Pierce County, King County, Snohomish County, Kitsap County, I mean, with the Navy bases and the military bases, it's a huge part of our economy. And we have had people who have been devoted almost single-mindedly in the past to protecting and enhancing that. Scoop Jackson, the former late senator from Washington State, Norm Dix, the former congressman who represented the area where JBLM, much of it is located, were dogged pro-defense, pro-military spending Democrats. And it's always struck me as kind of interesting that, you know, sort of liberal peacenik Seattle is resting on this bed of defense and military economy. And we don't really like to recognize it. But when you look at the numbers, it's pretty amazing. And these kinds of debates do, I think, Patricia, gives us some really interesting detail. I mean, Scoop Jackson and those guys had to make arguments about why the Puget Sound region was particularly well located to handle the Soviet threat. Or to handle, it was obvious during World War II, it was a shipment point of troops to the Pacific. So if we're undergoing a Pacific shift in our strategy, they have some arguments to make beyond just this will be bad for business in South Tacoma.
Patricia Murphy, thanks for bringing us the story.
Oh, you got it, Bill.
On KUOW's Week in Review, in a moment, medical pot, recreational pot. Two regulatory systems enter. One regulatory system leaves. Maybe. That's in a moment. Stay tuned. We can review on KUOW with Deborah Wong, who's with both KUOW and KCTS, Knute Berger, Crosscut and Seattle Magazine, and to Jonathan Martin with the Seattle Times. Jonathan, they're talking about we've got to make some kind of change to this rickety double system we have, recreational marijuana, medical marijuana. What seems to be the leading contender here for what's going to happen?
Well, I'll try to avoid any kind of cheesy metaphors or anything like that.
Thank you.
Smoke clearing the air, I think.
Right.
So just it really is helpful to go back just a very brief history here. The state was one of the first to legalize medical marijuana back in 1998. And we're really on the leading edge. I think we were one of the second or third states to do it. So that the industry, it was an industry that grew up around that, particularly since about 2010. When people saw that California basically was sort of leading the way on this idea of a storefront dispensary. And then, of course, we legalized recreational marijuana a couple years ago. The problem for the medical system has been that it's never explicitly legal. Christine Gregoire did everybody a big disservice by vetoing a bill several years ago that would have really brought a regulatory framework around dispensaries. And instead, you have this really gray area. You know, it hasn't been charged because, particularly since Dan Satterberg, I think both doesn't see the viability of juries convicting on charging dispensaries. But also, you know, there's a question about the law is so badly written at this point. So what we have now is a medical marijuana industry that is vastly larger than the recreational market. How big? We don't know. There's not a license. There's not real tax collection. There's not any kind of regulation. So I think that there's a real path forward here to melding the medical system into the recreational system, into a regulatory framework, but they have to do it very carefully. Remember, we legalize medical marijuana for a reason. There's very sick people that benefit from using marijuana, and they are maybe not appropriate to be paying the huge sin taxes that we put on recreational use.
How much more expensive would medical marijuana get if this were regulated?
You know, this
differently.
One of the really interesting things about covering this industry is that there are some market. There's really you could have a purely market forced economy. I mean, if you really just opened up the throttle and let everybody who can grow and sell to recreational stores, it's a supply and demand issue. You can really we could really dramatically lower the price. Mark Kleiman, the expert that the state hired in setting up the 502 market, said the real concern is you have it too cheap. I mean, it is so cheap to grow marijuana that it's like basically hops. So you actually have to prop the price up if you were going to have a really open market. So the state has had a real regulatory stranglehold, not stranglehold, that's maybe it's an over, but real strong hold on the production because the feds have said if you don't, we can come in and quash this whole thing.
Yeah, so the feds.
There's real tension there.
Right now, the FDA doesn't approve marijuana. The DEA doesn't approve it. The FBI doesn't approve it. You know, no insurance covers medical marijuana. Could more regulation and study lead to FDA approval? Could it be good news for medical marijuana patients someday?
It seems like we're headed that way. I think that Obama has certainly given every sort of wink and nod and nudge that way. More than half the states now are medical marijuana or recreational marijuana states. This has been a real sort of grassroots, state by state federalist revolt. So, you think you have, 2/3 of the country living in medical marijuana states? So I don't think you can put – we're not going back to just say no, Nancy Reagan. It didn't work. So
how does this play out, though? I mean, what are the proposals that are out there to – I mean, is it literally to just get rid of all of these dispensaries that are out there and do it through the 502 infrastructure? Or does some of that allow – do they allow some of that to, you know, to continue to exist?
There's different proposals out there by both in the Senate by a Republican, Ann Rivers, and a Democrat, Jeannie Cole Wells. Both of them essentially would have a path for grandfathering in dispensaries that are playing as much by the rules as you can in a system where there aren't any rules. But people have business licenses, people that are paying taxes, that kind of thing. So there is – that's the idea is you fold those into – give them a state license for what they're already doing. That would be –
Well, it's interesting because the state has an interest, an economic interest in having the, you know, price be relatively high and having, controlling the supply limit, you know, and then collecting tax revenues on that, and also not getting in trouble with the feds. The commercial people want the prices to be high. They don't want to be undercut by the medical marijuana. So it's just a really interesting balancing act. The other thing is that with the medical system, there's just been a wink and a nod where a lot of people could get marijuana there with just a letter from a doctor saying, oh, he's got back pain or whatever. Well, you know, 90% of us have back pain of some kind. So you've lowered the bar is lowered beyond where it would necessarily be lowered if to have an actual prescription and that kind of thing. So it's and then you have the, you know, how can medical marijuana people grow their own marijuana? And if so, how much? They can now. But my understanding is at least one of the proposals would reduce pretty dramatically the amount people would be able to grow on their own. So, it just strikes me as really complex. And it's a lot of the interests aren't necessarily on what people do with marijuana or whether they ought to be having it. It's more over the money and who gets the money and how that flows and whether the tax coffers will fill up enough.
One of the interesting questions in this is whether or not we're going to allow home grows. Oregon just passed a recreational marijuana law that allows home grows. Colorado has home grows. Jeannie Cole Wells' bill would allow version of this. This is the Democratic version, would allow six plant home grows. So that's going to be really a fascinating debate in the legislature. You know, the voters have sent a message on this, but how comfortable are we with home grows? I don't know.
I don't know. Don't look at me.
I don't know. What do you guys
think? Why are you looking at me?
Well, I mean, people can make beer at home, right?
I mean,
yeah. So
and wine.
Beer and wine, you can make that so that you know, that's legal. And anyway, I don't know why that would be a problem, but you can see why they want to limit it.
Speaking of the feds, you know, it's nice that we don't have a lot of mafia killings here in Seattle. We don't have a Gambino, Genovese, Gigante violence here. On the other hand, we also don't get to have Corleone, Sopranos, bada bing, forget about it. Over. We can't have that here either. So when Seattle got a racketeering case involving the names Colacurcio, Rossellini, and Conti with strippers and possible bribery of city council members, admit it, we enjoyed the Strippergate story for a long time here. Here are some excerpts from Seattle Times coverage over the years. Frank Colacurcio Jr. became the last don of his family's strip club empire. His ringtone, the movie theme from The Godfather. Conti did a soft shoe dance step, declaring, I didn't do nothing. And this week, when the Times reported that Frank Colacurcio Jr. was back working at an adult nightclub, the lead was, just when he thought he was out, she pulled him back in.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Seattle Times' Jonathan Martin, why is this news this week?
I was thinking that the mob prosecutors around the country must just laugh if this is sort of what
passes.
Yeah, this is what passes. The Colacurcios are a sort of fascinating local artifact. There has been, you know, the senior Colacurcio did spend some time in prison. His son has been in trouble. But, you know, I don't know. I this feels to me more like sort of a interesting piece of history than something that really says much about our region.
Uh-huh. So just briefly to catch you up, Frank Colacurcio Jr. he's done his time and he's back. Why didn't they just not even allow him to ever set foot into a strip club again?
Well,
can't they do that?
I think they gave him 3 years.
3 years.
Something like that. But the thing that was really fascinating about that story is that he really does make it seem as if he's back very reluctantly. He had tried to get work in like a warehouse job, but he just said, you know, my name, you know, I got this name. No one's going to hire me.
Right.
So what does he do? Well, what does he know how to do? He knows how to run strip clubs. So he's back in the strip club business as a consultant.
As a consultant.
Yeah.
Well, they'll have to monitor him pretty carefully. I mean, the Colacurcio Frank Sr. Had a knack for being the hidden partner in all kinds of operations. So nightclubs, go-go places, strip clubs. And he, in fact, was a prime mover.
Is there a difference between a nightclub, a go-go place, and a strip club? What's a go-go place?
Well, back in the 60s, they couldn't strip, but they could dance.
Oh, okay.
So that was like a go-go thing in the 60s. And when they sort of hit town, Colacurcio was one of the main guys behind them in Tacoma and whatnot. So so there's a history in the family of disguising to some degree, the true extent of their involvement in these operations, precisely because they wanted to stay off the radar screens because of previous convictions, previous prosecutorial scrutiny, and that kind of thing. And it is an interesting story. I mean, with the name Frank Colacurcio, even with the junior tacked on the end, your reputation is probably kind of established when you walk into the room. People aren't necessarily going to look at you on other sorts of merits. But this tiptoeing back into the business that he grew up in and that he knows and that has been the family business for so long, it doesn't surprise me at all that it would raise eyebrows. But it's, yeah, it is a classic Seattle ongoing story, kind of like the Kalakala of crime.
Yes. Yes.
But it also seems like a throwback in the sense that the industry, I mean, what's happened to the strip club industry? Is there a strip club industry left in Seattle? I mean, there, lakes, you know, the old strip clubs along Lake City are gone. You know, South Lake Union, I mean, that whole dead triangle, Belltown used to be filled with them. And where are they now?
Well, the scandal up in Snohomish County over the drive-in latte places.
Right.
That were strip
that's
clubs.
Where they're...
One of the principals involved was alleged to be a former employee of one of Colacurcio's strip joints. So people learn this business. It's an incredibly lucrative business. The sex business is huge in Seattle, both online and offline. Mm. And so there's tons of money to be made. It's a constant temptation, but it morphs. It's not in
it
the
adapts.
Same
way.
Right. It's not brick and mortar anymore. It's all.
And Colacurcio was an adapter. I mean, Frank Colacurcio himself adapted his business as the laws changed, as he found ways to get around the rules and that kind of thing over time. He used to be in the pinball business, in the punch tab business.
The pinball business?
Yeah.
Is that a big industry?
It was. They were illegal in Seattle because people played for money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was part of the old tolerance policy thing where the police were taking bribes to allow these illegal operations to take place. Guys like Colacurcio would go in and rough up people. You know, it morphed into the nightclub business, the nightlife business.
I always thought the Strippergate name was a far better name than actually the scandal itself was.
Sure. Mm.
Do you remember this was over like three parking spots outside a strip club, and there was like about $5,000 in donations that got hidden to city council members. So, I mean, I go back to my original point. This like mob prosecutors in the other parts of the country like look at this and say, oh, that's very cute.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. But the other part of it is, remember, Al Capone went to jail for tax evasion.
Right.
In other words, these operations, don't kid yourself. They were big operations, tons of money involved, people getting hurt. They weren't playing at this business, what I'm saying.
There were some deaths that never got officially connected, right, to the business and to Colacurcio, but it was part of the investigation.
Yes, there were allegations that witnesses and others involved in nightlife business mysteriously dying and that kind of thing. If you look into the history of it, you'll see lots of speculation about that.
And also, I guess it's just speculation, but it seems accepted wisdom that the Seattle Police Department, individuals in it, were taking bribes from this outfit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a pretty fairly recent history of really some bad actors in the Seattle Police Department. And this the federal investigation of this really kind of popped that open back in the, I believe, 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, those were the days.
Yes.
Nothing is...
It's like ancient history, isn't it? 80s?
I know. And how weird is it? It was actually in this story they quoted Frank Colacurcio Jr. as looking at Lake City Way and the old strip club, Rick's, right?
Yep.
Is now, isn't it a medical marijuana dispensary?
Yep. It is.
And he's saying, so...
Our vices morph here.
Yeah. And I did time for something that is, it's legal in Nevada, you know, and here at my old strip club is something that's federally illegal. And... It's just fine. Love it. Okay, it's KOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and we're getting wise about we have wise guys here for the week in review. It's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business. We're going to be back in a moment, and we're going to wrap up the very most important stuff that took place this week. So stay tuned. You know, I do this show once, and then I listen to it again on podcast. Do you guys listen to the show again on podcast, even though you're the ones whose mouths the show came out of?
Can't do that.
No, you don't.
I hear myself.
Oh, really?
Hard.
Okay, well, to you, the listener, I recommend you can go to, I do it through iTunes, but Stitcher. You can go to KUOW.org and find out how to do that. We're live tweeting at KUOW, at KUOW, and we're, of course, on Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. We've got Deborah Wong here from KCTS9 and KUOW, and Knute Berger and Jonathan Martin, too. And did anybody see the State of the Union address this week? Anything you noticed about State of the Union from Obama?
I like the review of it. It said that he was so loose that he was like channeling like Bulworth and Chris Rock.
Wow!
he was winking. He was loose.
Yeah.
That I think the fact that he no longer is expected to actually have any of his legislative proposals taken seriously kind of frees him up.
Sure.
I missed that because I listened to it on the radio, so I didn't see the body language. Yeah.
The New York Times' Tim Egan wrote that Obama's decided to be Russell Wilson after throwing four interceptions. It's how you finish the game, kid. But we mentioned earlier the parallels between this Washington and that Washington, Knute.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things is that Obama, in his speech, I listened to it on KOW, as a matter of fact, and also read the speech because they released the speech to the public in advance, which they didn't used to do. And that was interesting to see where he ad-libbed or not. But one of the things that's interesting is both Obama and Jay Inslee are sort of playing this game of coming out with these progressive and ambitious legislative items that target the middle class and the environment and other things when they're really dead on arrival. I mean, there's no chance of passage. I mean, by the time the words are out of their mouth, they've been completely rejected by the other party and
right.
a few wavering members of their own party. But it's interesting politics because as I listen to it, all I could think of is he's setting up 2016. You know, he's showing that the Democrats have a positive agenda. He's expecting it to be thwarted by Congress. He can go back to the people in 2016 when people actually turn out and vote, unlike midterms.
Yep.
And can say, hey, here's a path for the middle class forward. So I thought it was real. I thought the best line of the speech was, you know, anybody who's tried to live on $15,000 a year, you know, I mean, you should try it if you haven't.
Right.
I'm talking about the minimum wage and that kind of thing. So
his big theme was addressing inequality, which Governor Inslee is talking about in Washington State.
Exactly. And looking at how to make the tax system more progressive. Both of them are talking about capital gains adjustments both of them are talking about global warming and the environment, how to address that. So it's very interesting to see them operating in parallel, but they're also operating under some not quite parallel, but nearly parallel opposition, because in the legislative branch, the Democrats are not in control.
Fairness is a good issue for the Democrats. I think everybody gets this intuitively. It was interesting to see Mitt Romney start to have his rehabilitation campaign, and he's talking about income inequality and opportunity. It's going to be hard to walk back that 47% problem, but it makes sense to people because everybody feels that that their paychecks have not rebounded like they did from the recession. And you see the incredible wealth being clustered in not just the top 1%, but like the top 1% of the 1%.
Well,
and it doesn't feel like there's a path up there anymore. It doesn't feel like there's the ladder is broken.
And let's talk about the attempt to raise some of those taxes on the wealthy here in Washington State. Is Tim Iman through? Asked the Seattle Times. 6 months ago, is the Initiative King's 15-year run of anti-tax influence history? This isn't just liberal wishful thinking, wrote columnist Danny Westnead. The head of a state association for grocery stores had said that the business community was discussing how Iman had gotten off track, he wasn't coming back, and how's he going to be replaced. Westnead also wisely wrote, if I know Iman, the reports of his death are greatly exaggerated. This week, Tim Iman filed we found out that he has filed 17 state initiatives. How powerful is this guy?
Well, I mean, I think the reason that people were writing him off a year or two ago is that he's not been able to raise the money that he needs to hire signature gatherers. And I think last year he only raised $100,000 or something like that. And so he may have filed 17 initiatives, but can he raise the money from the business community to actually hire the signature gatherers to get those through? I don't know. It's a big
you know, the irony is that his real signature idea was his two-thirds limit on taxes. And, you know,
it's the requirement that if you're going to raise taxes, you need to...
It's been passed five times by voters.
Yeah, a two-thirds majority.
A two-thirds majority to raise taxes. Thrown out as unconstitutional again and again. But the state Senate this year basically took up the... Tim Iman isn't dead because his idea is still alive, and the state Senate picked it up and imposed it on themselves.
How much does Tim Iman still matter?
Well, I think I certainly think he matters. First of all, this is his business. So, you know, he throws a lot of stuff against the wall, see what sticks, see what he can get signatures for. Many of these initiatives that he's proposing now all relate to the two-thirds thing. He's got an initiative that says we're going to repeal the sales tax until there's a two-thirds rule in the state constitution. We're going to repeal this tax, that tax. So he's really on the two-thirds deal very strong here. But you also see a lot of other kind of golden oldies in there. He's got $30 tabs is back. We know Tim Iman doesn't like red light cameras. He wants those to be voters. We know Tim Iman doesn't like toll roads. He's got a toll initiative in there, which would put tolls to a public vote, and it would also limit what you could spend toll revenues on. He wants, you know, you toll the bridge, you pay for the bridge, you take the toll off, as opposed to where I think transportation policy is heading, is kind of permanent tolls everywhere to control drive. So his ideas matter because he passes a fair number of these initiatives, and even when they're thrown
he
out.
He does? Is it because of him? Is the Tim?
Yeah, well, he's the one puts them out, advocates for them. And I think
we have other signature gatherers.
He doesn't win every time by any measure, but he is able to win consistently on certain issues, particularly bread and butter stuff. And he is persistent. Very persistent.
What I tell my kids to be.
Yeah, exactly.
He is.
He's very persistent. So, yes, I think he still matters, but he can be defeated. And people will support other initiatives like spending lots of money we don't have for class sizes. So,
well, that one of the interesting ideas that was filed this week in the legislature, Senator named Joe Fain, is a moderate Republican from South King County, got pretty much the entire Senate across from the Tea Party to the far left to agree to sign on to a bill that would require initiatives to say how they are going to be paid for.
A constitutional amendment.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is...
You can't even file the initiative unless it includes a way to pay for it.
Yep. Yep. And this is a direct response to Initiative 1351, the class size initiative, which was very popular, but incredibly expensive with no way of paying for it. But I think you see the folks on the left see this is basically an Iman inoculation. And the folks on the right see this as sort of neutering the ideas like the Washington Education Association, the Teachers Union, filed with 1351. So an equal opportunity, you know.
And finally, we have barely touched on the most dramatic event in Seattle sports history last Sunday. But the interesting thing I found this week that I learned is that the man who caught the game-winning ball is going to prison. Let me explain. Jermaine Kearse, the receiver, caught the touchdown, the winning touchdown. He's so excited, he throws the ball into the crowd. A guy named Scott Shelton catches the ball, supposedly gets an offer of $20,000 from a memorabilia collector. But instead, he gives it to the football player, to Jermaine Kearse, in exchange for a signed jersey and helmet. So he's already getting mocked for that. Then it comes out that the day after the Super Bowl, this man will be heading to prison to serve 26 months for unlawful possession of a firearm. So it's one of those, what would you do? Shelton told Cairo Radio, you can't put a price on this piece of Seattle history. Yeah, you can. The price is $20,000. But instead, he took a jersey and a helmet from a guy who makes a $500,000 a year. Dumb? Heroic? Anybody? The 12th man rising?
Wait a minute. So let me just understand this. So the ball was given back to Kearse, and he, in exchange, he got a helmet and a jersey.
Right, instead of selling.
He did the right thing. He did the right thing. And you're giving him a hard time for doing the right thing?
Why is it the right thing? It's his ball.
No, but he gave it back to he gave it back.
For a handful of magic beans? How about a little more than, how about Super Bowl tickets at the very...
If the reverse had happened and he had...
His children are about to lose their father to prison for 2 years.
You would have given him such a hard time if he had actually sold that ball.
No, you would have given him a hard time. That's what you're here for. I'm here to say, good man, for providing for your children for a change.
Well, you sound like a pure capitalist there, Bill. You work in public radio.
Exactly. Good point.
That's why he has to act out what he can.
He would have taken the $20,000. Let's be clear about that.
But it's just money. Jermaine Kearse has plenty of money, so what's the...
Jermaine
Kearse can buy it back from the memorabilia collector.
He'll be friends
collector.
For life, and he'll...
He'll be friends with
Jermaine. Absolutely.
Okay.
He'll write him in...
Ladies and gentlemen, the triumph of sports marketing right there. He also said this.
I don't need that $20,000. That's a... The memory of meeting Kearse and giving the ball back and being etched in the play and just being a part of that is worth more than 20 grand. You can't put a price on that.
You don't have to trade the experience of being a part of that. Just trade the football for $20,000.
I suspect he's going to get mocked when he goes to prison, too.
I don't know. I thought that was the best part of the story, was that he was just unembarrassed about the fact that he was going to jail. And he just said, yeah, I had the illegal firearms. I got convicted. I'm going to go pay my dues. And, you know, I mean, it's so, you know, your private life. I mean, catch a football.
Yes.
Suddenly everyone's digging into your private life.
Yes.
I'm never going to catch a football. I can tell you that. Man. Or a baseball. Leave the mitt at home, man.
Sure. I wonder how the inmates would have treated him at the King County lockup if he was the guy who refused to give the Seahawks their ball back.
Sure.
Maybe he did the right thing.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Kearse is a hometown boy.
Yes, sir, from the University of Washington.
I like that his life turned around once he got LASIK surgery. When he was at the UW, he dropped all kinds of balls.
We'll have to put that in our podcast edition, because we're seconds away from being out of time here. Jonathan Martin from the Seattle Times, thank you.
Thank you.
Deborah Wong from In Close on KCTS and KUW, of course. Thanks, Deborah.
Thanks.
And Knut Berger, the Mossback from Crosscut.com, Seattle Magazine. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
The show's produced by Jason Pagano. We're going to 7 p.m. We're going to do it. So it's still going to be at 10 a.m., but also 7 p.m., the Week in Review, starting next week. Thank you, Patricia Murphy, and thank you for joining us. And let's do this again next week.
All right.
All right. KUW Seattle.